Good heavens, thank you for being interested in my Carolina journey. And it seems so incredibly mundane when we think about comparing it to what we just heard, which is so remarkable. And my story, my journey at Carolina, is very similar to yours. I wish I could hear your story, every one of you. It would mean the world, and maybe we will get to it at some point. But thank you for being interested in mine. I'm grateful. And in order to tell my Carolina story, please let me go all the way back to the beginning, because it starts pretty early. I was born, of course, in the rural South in 1937, in a little town in North Carolina called Albemarle. In 1937, everybody was poor. We were just coming out of the Depression. The Depression was sort of fading away. And the dogs of war were howling, as you know. World War II was coming. And my mom and dad were like so many other people of that era who came off of farms. Their families came off of farms. And what you did in those years when you came off of a farm is you went to work in a textile mill. That was what you did. And so my mother and dad were born and raised in Richmond County, North Carolina. And there were a number of textile mills there. So they stopped their schooling in the eighth grade because of the Depression. And they went to work in the textile mill. And so did everybody else. And they did their courting in the weave room at Hannah Pickett Cotton Mill in Rockingham, North Carolina. And after a while, they had courted enough and they got married. And they decided to come to Stanley County, which was about 50 miles away, to seek a better life. And they came to Stanley County and they got jobs in that textile mill. And in those years, if you were working at a textile mill, you stayed in the mill village. The great mills built houses for the people who worked there, and you would rent a house. As I recall, my dad saying it was $15 a month for a house. We'd be glad to have that now, wouldn't we? So I was born on this mill village. I can still hardly believe how plain life was. I still don't believe, and I have to ask my brother every now and then, is this really true? Did our mother really wash clothes in a wash pot out in the yard year round? Yes, she did. We had a big wash pot, sort of the kind that they cook in Africa, when you read the stories of the missionaries being cooked in the pot. Well, that's the kind of pot she had. We put sticks around the pot and started a fire, and we got water from a pump because we had no water in the house. And we took a bath once a week in one of the tubs that we used to wash the clothes. But again, this is not so unusual for us. It was just the way it was in the rural South. I was happy as I could be. We got along great. There was a little clapboard church on the edge of the village. We were there every time the door opened. Whatever the service was, we went to the church. But we stayed in the little mill village right there, and that's where I spent my years before going to Central Elementary School in Albemarle, North Carolina. In September of 1944, it's about what I figured this would be, my mother took me by the hand and took me to Central Elementary School. I remember it. And I was a little Mill Hill kid. I was, I think, pretty terrified. I'd never been to the school. I didn't know a single soul there. And so the teacher came around, Miss Miss Pauline Whitley, and she put a big piece of newsprint paper in front of every kid. And she put a carton of tempera paints in the middle of every table. And she said, paint anything you want to. Draw whatever you want to draw. It was 1944, and we were in the middle of the war. All the boys drew ships with airplanes dropping bombs. All the girls drew little stick figures and little houses. I don't know why, but I drew an enormous rabbit. It took up the whole page. I want to show you, because I replicated that in years later to try to remember exactly what that rabbit was like. I'm going to show you right now. This is that rabbit. So I finished the rabbit. I painted the rabbit white, its eye pink, the grass green, the sky blue, the sun orange, and I was through. A large woman, seemed very official, came into the room. She was the principal of the school, Miss B.C. Parker. Now, I'm going to connect this up, because Miss B.C. Parker is the reason I came to Chapel Hill, and that's why this makes some sense. Miss B.C. Parker came over to me, and she looked at my painting, and she said, my, oh my, what a wonderful rabbit. What a wonderful rabbit. I want you to hold this up for all the class to see. So I held it up. She said, now, I want to take this picture out in the hall, and we're going to put it up on the hall out there so everybody can see your rabbit. Great. So we went out and we put it up, taped it up on the hallway out there. And at that moment, I was magically transformed, as I look back at it, from a shy little Mill Hill kid to a kid who loved school. I was so excited about that, so thankful that this had happened to me. And during the decade after that, Miss B.C. Parker just simply took me under her wing. I want this boy in the Boy Scouts, she sent a note home to my mother. So they put me in the Boy Scouts. I want this boy to see the mountains. He's been drawing pictures of the mountains. I want you to take him. My mother and dad took me to see the mountains. This went on over and over. She stuck with me for the next 11 or 12 years for some reason. The only thing I can think is it was that rabbit. And I found out later that she was the moving force behind my nomination for Morehead Scholarship. Now, you know, they say that a teacher can affect eternity, and I think that's true. I think that rabbit got me to the University of North Carolina. So the world turned and the sun rose and set, and 1956 came around, and I miraculously got a Morehead Scholarship, and on August the 15th, 1956, I drove a 1937 Chevrolet that I bought from my high school coach for $125. I drove it to Chapel Hill and entered the school as a freshman class as a Morehead Scholar. Now, it had been my dream all those years to play football at UNC. I wanted to do that so much. I knew the names of all the players at Carolina. I followed the games as best I could. And by the summer of 1957, that would be the next year, it was looking like my dream might come true, that maybe I'd get to play. I was at home in Albemarle, working out, lifting weights, running every day, hoping I'd make the team. And we had a new football coach here at Chapel Hill. His name was Sonny Jim Tatum. He had been National Coach of the Year up at Maryland. He had invented the split tee as a coach at Oklahoma a few years before that. He was a huge man, and to me, he dwelled in an approachable light. I had so much confidence in him and respect for him. So this was a weeknight in early August, and I'm thinking I'm going to make the team this year. I was home with my mom and dad, and as I said, I was working out. And my old high school girlfriend, Dottie Walker, called me. She was a great kid and very important to me. She called the house about 7:30 in the evening. She said, "Guess what? What? I've been invited to make my debut, and I want you to be my marshal." I said, "What? What's a debut?" She says, "A dance over in Raleigh." Well, I knew I didn't want to go. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I said, "When is it?" She said, "It's September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. I knew I was saved, because that would be right in the middle of football practice. I had the perfect excuse. So I said, "Oh, I'm so sad." I could just cry about this. "But I can't go," I said, "because that's the middle of early football practice. And you know how it would go over if I said I had to miss practice because I had to go to a dance." Well, she started crying and hung up the phone. And about 15 minutes passed, and the phone rang again. It was my girlfriend, Dottie Walker, again. "Guess what?" "What?" "My mother called Coach Tatum, and he wants you to go to the dance. And he's going to call you in a few minutes." I said, "You have ruined my life." In 15 minutes, the phone rang. And it was, sure enough, Sonny Jim Tatum, National Coach of the Year, inventor of the split tee. He said, "Waiter, Mrs. Walker has called me." I interrupted him. I said, "Coach, thank you so much. I appreciate you calling, but I've taken care of that." I said, "I've explained that I can't go to that dance because it would be in the middle of early practice." He said, "Oh, no, Wade." He said, "This is the kind of thing we want our young men to do." Yeah, I had one last card to play. I said, "Well, Coach Tatum, I wouldn't have any way over to the dance because they have that thing over in Raleigh, and I wouldn't have any way over there." He said, "Well, Wade, Mrs. Walker and I have worked that out." He said, "You'll take your tuxedo down to Keenan Fieldhouse, and every day at 4:30, in the middle of practice, I'll announce on the PA system, 'Wade Smith, it's time for you to go to the debutante ball.' And you'll go down to Keenan Stadium and put on your tuxedo." And I said, "But I still, that won't help because I wouldn't have any way over there." He said, "Mrs. Walker and I have decided that you'll drive my new Oldsmobile." So, every day at 4:30, Coach Tatum announced on the PA system, in front of all my buddies, "Wade Smith, it's time for you to go to the debutante ball." I went down, put on my tuxedo, and drove his new Oldsmobile to Raleigh. Now, that would be an NCAA violation now for sure. The school would have been kicked out of the program. So, I made the team that year, and we had a pretty good season. One team deserves special mention, and that is this. Queen Elizabeth II, the Queen of England, was coming to visit America. And she was going to be in Washington. And she wanted to see a football game. And our game with Maryland would be in Maryland that year. And that game was chosen as the game she would see. The American football game she would see. The Queen of England. And we were notified that we would be playing a game before the Queen of England, and we were very proud of that, and we worked hard to be ready. We practiced hard, and we took our very best uniforms up there, the prettiest uniforms we had, and we polished up our shoes, and all of us got nice haircuts, and we looked nice. We looked like nice young men, and the day arrived, and there was great pomp and circumstance and ceremony, and right down there on the front row, there she was, the Queen of England, to see our football game. And, well, the Queen wasn't the only reason that was an important game, because that was the northernmost trip we would take that year. Now, we had many, many great boys from Pennsylvania and New York playing on the team. And this was our northernmost route that year. And their mothers and dads, and especially their girlfriends, wanted to come down and see that team and get to be with the boys and see the game. And we would spend the night. We had planned to spend the whole night. And they would get to, the girls would see the boyfriends, and the mothers and dads would get to hug the boys. And it would just be a wonderful thing. And we played the game. It was October 19, 1957. Believe it or not, we lost. We lost that game. Coach Tatum was furious. We were ushered onto the bus. We had to take the bus over to the dressing rooms to shower. We were ushered onto that bus. He got on the bus. He said, "We're going home. We're not staying tonight. You lost this game, and we're going home to Chapel Hill. No moms and dads, no girlfriends. We're going home. You made asses of yourselves before the Queen," he said. "And if you make asses of yourself before the Queen, we're going home." Well, there was great weeping and wailing. Boys were sad. Parents standing outside the bus, stretching their arms up. Shaky little hands. Curly-headed boys on the bus weeping, girlfriends reaching up and touching the hands of the boys they hadn't seen in a month or two or three. No matter. We got on the airplane. We came home. That next week of practice was the worst week of practice I ever remember. And frankly, I'm just healing from it. I'm just getting over it. Well, that was 1957. The next year, my junior year, we had a great season. We beat Southern California out there. We beat Tennessee at Knoxville. We beat Miami at Miami. It was a very heady time. Very exciting. And 1959 rolled around. That would be my last year. And if I may say so, I was elected captain of the team for my senior year. And we were number three in the nation. Preseason. Now it was early August. I was home again. No, my girlfriend didn't call. I was home again working out, getting ready. It was evening, and I heard my mother and dad were listening to the news, and over the news, word came. Sonny Jim Tatum, National Coach of the Year, died. He died of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Just like that, he was gone. We gathered the team. We tried to pull ourselves together. There was a great celebration of his life at the University Methodist Church. We laid him to rest in the old cemetery across from Carmichael Auditorium. You can see the marker today if you want to. It reads, "Jim Tatum, National Coach of the Year." And I wanted to engrave on the bottom of it, "He also helped a small town girl, have a date for the dance." But I didn't put it on there. We dedicated the last game of the season that year to Sonny Jim Tatum. It was played on Thanksgiving Day on national television, 1959. We played it over at Duke. Did we win the game? We beat them 50-0. They are still pissed, if I may use that word. In the months after the dead ball, my girlfriend Dottie drifted away, searching for a better dancer. Maybe for a boy who had his own new Oldsmobile, I don't know, seeking a more radiant and handsome companion. She moved to California, married, had many children. She died a few years ago. I went to her funeral, and I was invited to speak at her funeral, and I told the story of her mother and Coach Tatum to the absolute delight of her children, who had never heard that story. Then on a beautiful autumn evening in October 1958, I'd made my way over to Girard Hall for a meeting of candidates for various offices. And there I was made numb from head to toe by the beauty of a young woman whose father had brought her across the mountain from Bristol, Virginia. Her name was Ann. Pretty soon after that, we got married. And we'd been together for 58 years. Many wonderful things happened to me at Carolina, but none could compete with that look. There's so many things I'm going to tell you about my years at Chapel Hill. I won't be able to tell you all of them, of course. But I must tell you about the 1957 basketball team, coached by Frank McGuire. Coach Smith was not yet the head coach at Chapel Hill. It was a round ball year to remember forever. 32 games in a row we won. There was not a single loss. We played Kansas for the national championship at Municipal Stadium in Kansas City. They had a little guy named Wilt Chamberlain. And in a game on March 23, 1957, through three overtimes, we beat Kansas 54-53 for the national championship. Moving along and finishing up, there were many great professors here. I will remember them as long as I live. Dr. Bernard Boyd taught religion. You remember him, I'm sure. Dr. Hugh Leffler taught North Carolina history. He was wonderful. Dr. Lyman Cotton in English, and Dr. J. Penrose Harlan in classics. Does anybody remember Dr. Harlan? Oh, wonderful man. My chancellor was William Brantley Acock, a man for the ages. Wherever students gathered at that time, those years, you could see former chancellor Robert House among these students playing his harmonica. He had two songs. He played only two songs. One was titled "Roll On Boys, Don't Roll So Slow, The Sun Will Go Down and You'll Roll No More." The title of his song was always all the words to that song. The other one was "Peekaboo, You Rascal, You Get Out From Behind That Chair." That was my favorite one. On May 9th, 1960, a week before my graduation, Dr. King came and spoke on the campus, and this visit changed many, many lives. I went on in my life, largely based on that experience, entered politics, served in the General Assembly, and did my best to advance Dr. King's dream. And while I was a jock at Carolina, I was a serious student, I want you to know. I took my studies very seriously. I was a Morehead Scholar. I was expected to. And only a few times did professors treat me with some slight disdain, expecting me to be a jock and not interested in academics. I never felt I was disadvantaged by that at all. And only one time did I ever really feel I got a break because I was an athlete. I took a classics course under the wonderful and unforgettable Dr. J. Penrose Harlan, a wonderful teacher and a saint. So we were to play Notre Dame that Saturday, and Dr. Harlan announced our most important midterm exam on Friday, before the game. And I explained to Dr. Harlan I'd have to miss the exam. He said, "Well, Wade, don't worry about that. You can take a makeup exam on Monday." Great. So we played the game, came back. I studied on Sunday. And on Monday, after the class was over, I went over to Dr. Harlan and said, "Dr. Harlan, I'm ready to take the makeup exam." He said, "What makeup exam?" I panicked. I said, "Dr. Harlan, remember, I mentioned to you I was going to be on the football trip, and I'd have to take a makeup exam." He looked at me and said, "Wade, you took that exam and made an A." I was a little worried about that until I realized right away, everybody in the class made an A, even those who didn't attend the exam. So I'll end this by saying, God bless and keep Dr. J. Penrose Harlan, beautiful man, beautiful university. Thank you for hearing me.